All rise.
Be seated, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 080453, Jeffrey Klein, M.D., and Baylor College of Medicine versus Cynthia Hernandez as the parent and next friend in age.
May it please the court, Mr. Pope will present argument for the petitioner. It has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
With the court's permission, I will begin by addressing Dr. Klein, because the non-suit against Baylor left no case or controversy as regard to that particular entity.
There's no dispute about that anymore, is that right? As the way I read the briefing, everybody kind of agrees on that.
Everybody agrees to a certain extent, except as to the effect of the non-suit. Baylor maintains at this juncture that the non-suit requires the vacation of the Court of Appeals opinion and the district court's order, insofar as it applies to Baylor. Obviously, Dr. Klein, the order and the Court of Appeals opinion is not vacated because of the non-suit. The non-suit applies only to Baylor. So we are agreed in that respect.
As to Baylor?
As to Baylor, yes. As to Dr. Klein, the Court of Appeals essentially held that he was not entitled to an interlocutory appeal because, for those purposes, he's not an employee of a state agency and thus has no immunity to assert. That flies in the face of the language of the statute, language of Chapter 312 of the Texas Health and Safety Code, and its legislative history. Section 312.007A expressly provides two purposes for which Dr. Klein is an employee of a state agency. One of those purposes is Chapter 104, indemnity. That's not an issue at the moment. The other purpose is determining the liability, if any, for his acts or omissions at the school. At the school in terms of the care that it provides at Ben Tolba Public Hospital.
So can we just simplify this by saying that any time a private entity enters into a contract with a state agency, then that employee of the private entity becomes a public or state employee?
No, Your Honor, we cannot simplify it in that way because Baylor in these respects is not a private entity. It is a specific entity, and in fact, Chapter 312 is designed expressly for Baylor. That is its only real function. And if you trace back the legislative history, Chapter 312 is a non-substantive revision of Article 4494T, which itself is directed, and if you look at the legislative history of that, the bill analyses are directed expressly to Baylor. They apply only to Baylor because at the time, this is in 1987 when it was enacted, the Harris County Health Hospital District, rather, was going to create a new entity and wanted Baylor's assistance in providing that care. And in the bill analysis, in both the Senate Health and Human Services Committee and the House Education Committee, both look at that purpose and expressly say, at the time, the Baylor people were treated differently from the UT people. And so as part of that coming together for the new entity, part of the deal, if you will, is that Baylor people would get, and this is in the bill analysis, equal liability, the same treatment. And so when they are providing care in that particular public hospital or those entities that are part of the Harris County Hospital District, then yes, Baylor is not, insofar as you will, a private entity just for that care. Now, and this is in the record, obviously Baylor provides care at a number of other institutions, Memorial Hospital in Harris County, Texas Children's Hospital, Texas Women's Hospital. When Baylor residents are providing care at those facilities, then no, they are still private entities and the same rules apply to them as any other physician. But when we are strictly talking here about the care that they provide for the Harris County Hospital District under this coordinating entity arrangement that the legislature has set up for just this purpose, then they are not a private entity. They are, in effect, borrowing state agency status.
And is that for all purposes or just
the extent and limits of liability? Would it apply to notice, for example?
Well, it depends on how you look at how you define liability. I submit that it's, for all purposes, it's limited in the sense that it applies only to the care that they provide at these places and only in that sense. But
to put a fine point on it, does 101.101A, notice requirement, apply to Baylor in these circumstances?
Well, in this particular case, no, because we're dealing with the old 101. 106. Oh, sorry, I missaid 101. Yes.
So it's, in your view, Baylor just becomes a state agency for purposes of Chapter 101, all of its provisions?
For the care that it provides at that particular institution, and if you are suing them for the acts and omissions, for someone's acts and omissions at that particular institution, then yes. For the care that it provides elsewhere, no, and it's limited in that sense, because...
Would 101-106F, which we talked about in the last case, would that also apply? So Dr. Klein is sued, and then can he move to dismiss so that they state the claim against Baylor? Would that be the case?
Well, not in this particular case, no. Dr. Klein would not get the benefit of that for this particular case, because obviously it arose before the amendment.
Well, let's say, after the amendment, and let's say it's the same kind of case as last time.
Yes, he would get the benefit of that. If it was after the effective date, then yes, he would, for that care. If he was working at another facility for Baylor, then no, but it's limited in that sense. Yeah. But that's the whole point of the Act. Chapter 312 is designed for that very purpose, to make Baylor equal to UT, because they are providing the same care to the same people in the same facilities under the same public funds. That's part of the arrangement. With regard to Dr. Klein in this particular instance, we are talking about determining the liability. And the Court of Appeals read that narrowly and didn't actually provide any kind of guidance as to what determining the liability means. The case, the majority rather, pointed it out as a grant of limited liability, but did not go on to explain why such a grant would not entitle Dr. Klein to raise any other kind of affirmative defense or any kind of defense that any other state agency employee would be able to raise. Justice Taft, in his concurrence, disagreed with that notion from the majority and pointed out that it should, determining liability, if any, is an adjudicative process which encompasses same rules of law and the same affirmative defenses that are open to any other state agency employee. And submit that that has to be the way that determining liability, if any, is read. If you look at the way 312.007 is set up, determining liability has to be read broadly within the context of the purpose and point of Chapter 312.
It says, of course, the one problem with this case is we're looking at it through the filter of jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
So it gets kind of murky a little bit. But when 312.006A says is not liable, is that the same as immunity, or is it just for purposes of appeal under the interlocutory appeal statute, or is it something else?
Well, I'll go with the first one. It is not liable, and you've got to read the rest of it, except to the extent and up to the maximum amount of liability of 101.023A, and then there's that comma, and then for the acts and omissions of a governmental unit of state government. So it is not liable, relates also to the except to the extent, and then you have to read the last part of 312.006A, because obviously 101.023A does not contain any kind of specific governmental unit of state government requirement. It just is a very broad provision of liability of state government. So it doesn't contain the same kind of restriction, except to the extent, and is not liable, the way that the sentences are structured, have to relate to that last part. Is not liable except to the extent for the acts and omissions of a governmental unit of state government. So in that sense, it's a governmental unit, again, for the limited purposes of providing care at Harris County Health District, Hospital District, rather, it has to be read broadly to afford the same kinds of rights as any other state agency, particularly when you consider that in the context of 312.007A, because here, of course, we are dealing with an individual who's being sued and sought to be held liable for his action and omissions. And there, 312.007A says, is a state agency for those purposes that we've previously discussed, one of which is implicated in this case. So under both 312.006A and 312.007A, Baylor is a state agency and thus is a governmental unit. So were it still in the case, where there's still a case or controversy, Baylor would be entitled to bring an interlocutory appeal.
Now, the other side, I think, argues that there's no express language to state that, and you're kind of reading that too broadly.
Well, I disagree with the notion that it's not express, Your Honor. I think it's quite express. The legislature has created state agencies, is a state agency, is to me very express. For the acts and omissions of a governmental unit in 312.006A is similarly express. And what the legislature has typically done in these instances is have an establishment, if you will, an establishment of a state agency clause, and then this separate jurisdictional interlocutory appeal grant in 51.014. So, for instance, the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board is established in part of the Education Code, Chapter 61.034, I think, and it says is a state agency. Nowhere in that particular provision does it provide for an interlocutory appeal right there. No, but of course it relates to the 51.014. So if you're created as a state agency over here, then you get the rights that state agencies get. They don't have to be, and I think the Court of Appeals fell into the same trap of thinking that, well, if the legislature had wanted to be clear, they would have put it in 51.014, or they would have put it in 312. Well, that's not how they do it, typically, and not how they've done it in for other agencies that are clearly state agencies for all purposes. We've got the grant in 312, Chapter 312, and we've got the interlocutory appeal rights. So to think that they are somehow different, that they change, that it's a flexible definition of state agency, I don't think accords with legislative intent or the language of the statute.
To be clear, Chapter 312 only applied to Baylor when it was passed?
Well, if you look in... Yes, Your Honor. Well, if you look in 312.002, the definition section, supported medical school is one of those defined terms, and it says subchapter D of Chapter 61 of the Texas Education Code. Well, if you look in subchapter D of Section 61, you will see that it applies to contracts with Baylor Medical and Dental School. So it applies to those two entities.
So the answer is it only applied to Baylor when it was enacted?
Yes, and that was deliberate.
And it only applies to Baylor now?
As far as I'm aware, yes, Your Honor.
Are the doctors under this program who have committed the surgery or performed the medicine in a way that the statute applies, is that doctor entitled to representation by the state? Are they indemnified by the state under Chapter 104 as well?
Well, that is still something of an open question. They're obviously indemnified by Baylor under 312.007.
But they're a state agency, so can they get the, would the Attorney General defend a doctor if they, you know, notify them within 10 days, and then are they entitled to indemnity if there's a judgment against them from the state of Texas?
We would submit that they would be. And in this case, of course, we've not chosen to go that route, but they are a state agency. It is a state agency, so they would have that right. That is an open question somewhat with regard to how Chapter 104 would work, given the specific language in 312.007A, that perhaps it would have to be indemnification first through Baylor, and then Baylor would, of course, get the money from Harris County Hospital District through its arrangement with them. That's part of the deal, that Harris County and us taxpayers are ultimately responsible for any of these kind of indemnification claims or any liability determinations, we would submit. Let's be clear. Dr. Klein and Baylor are not asking for anything more than what a state agency and its state agency employees are entitled to. That's all that. No more, no less. That's what 312.007 and 312.006 do. They make Baylor and they make Dr. Klein and all Baylor's other residents, when they are performing services at a covered facility, it's undisputed that's the case here, they make them state agency employees and state agents, if you will. So my time is almost up. If there are no further questions.
I was just wondering what part of East Texas you were from.
New Zealand. Deep, deep West Texas, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Talaska will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Baylor College of Medicine's not before the court, as I think we've established. The sole issue is whether or not Dr. Klein, a private individual in the state of Texas, gets the entire protection of the Texas Tort Claims Act as if he were a state employee. And a reading of the statute that doctor is trying to apply to this case does not read the way they want it to read. The legislature did not put anything into section 3112 extending the entire Tort Claims Act to Baylor College of Medicine, nor did they extend the protections of the Tort Claims Act to individual physicians, nor did they grant sovereign immunity to either of these defendants.
What's the purpose of this statute?
The statute is, which we will concede, there is a limitation of liability in the case. If Baylor was a named defendant, which they are not, their limitation, their liability would be limited up to the amount that had University of Texas been sued. And we will concede that. That's the purpose of the limitation. The individual liability, the second part of 312, talks about the liability of an individual who's employed by Baylor would be capped as if they were an employee of the state. But the second half of that is there is no official immunity that applies in this case under the court's reasoning under Casson v. Hatley, which has recently been cited and approved again. The providing and issuance of medicine is not inherently a government function. It is a private discretion. Medical decisions are not made by the government, they're made by individuals. So the official immunity would not apply. What we have here, because we're dealing with old law, the old Tort Claims Act, this is a portion of the law that said, if you don't sue Baylor, just like if you don't sue the University of Texas Health Science Center or your medical branch, but just sue the individual physicians, they are not entitled to tort claims protection because they are not in their official capacity. That is extremely important in this case because under the old law, an individual private practicing physician, whether they worked for a UT or worked for Baylor or worked for themselves, had the same responsibility and accountability that is together because it's not an official immunity act. So in this case, Dr. Klein and Baylor College of Medicine are trying to read too much into the statute, which is simply a limitation on the liability.
Well, help me understand that, because the way I read it, it's probably too simple, but it seems like if Baylor and these doctors agreed to do this, perhaps charitable work, then the state has agreed to give them some protections. Is that too much of a simplification?
That is a simple way. That is a fair way to say that's why they get the limitation of liability. Because Baylor College of Medicine in the past did have larger judgments and settlements that against University of Texas, and that in terms of the financial component, put them on even footing. And so it's a limitation of liability as opposed to giving them the entire immunity of the Texas Tort Claims Act, which would then include things like having to give notice and misuse of tangible property, all of that which is not expressly stated in this section 312, nor is it implied in section 312.
Why not? It just says a covered entity, and I guess it's just Baker, is not liable except to the extent of liability of state government. And that would be for motor-driven vehicles and the use of condition of personal property, and if there was notice, and but not if there was discretion, and not subject to punitive damages, and the whole raft of things.
Yes, but that's not what the statute says.
Well, I just read it.
In reading
312006A says, Baylor, I'm just substituting that for the first 50 words, which describe all these things, which only include Baylor, I guess, kind of a special law, but that's a subject for another case. Baylor is not liable except to the extent of liability of state government. That's what it says.
Right. Except to the extent and up to the maximum amount of liability.
Right, and I see up to the maximum amount, but it also says to the extent. And the extent, doesn't extent import all of those other things?
I think that the extent has to do with the range of remedies that this specific statute will say that Baylor can be held up to the same amount of liability and to the extent of whatever other remedies that were available against UT, that those same remedies could be applied against UT.
So you think extent in that in 312006A refers to remedies and not to the 101.0022 definitions of what the government's going to be liable?
Yes, sir. I think the legislature is saying, Baylor, we're going to give you a cap, but don't take too much from that cap because you're going to be in the same position in terms of whatever remedies could be sought and the amount of money that could be sought from the state can be brought against you individually, Baylor. That's the way that this would be interpreted. Again, if we read that, a supported medical school is not liable for its accident admissions except to the extent and maximum of liability of state government. Again, trying to put them to the liability cap that would be in place for a government entity.
Well, but then 312007A says Baylor is a state agency for purposes of determining the liability of an employee.
And if we read that sentence, is a state agency and any of their physicians are employees of state agency for purposes of Chapter 104 Civil Practice and Remedies Code.
Right. And for purposes.
And then there's an and.
Of determining the liability of the person or the person's acts, omissions. It's that and that's bothered me.
Is a state agency, and then we look at them being a state agency, and then we look at the individual people who are employed by that medical school, that they both would then lead to Chapter 104, which has to do with whether or not an individual has immunity. And so reading that, those need to be read together, that, again, it goes to This whole 312007 has to do with individual liability.
And then do you agree that 312007B imports Section 101.106?
Yes, and I think that brings up an interesting point, because if they wanted to incorporate the whole tort claims, they could have said Baylor is a governmental agency subject to the same immunity and waiver of immunity of the Texas Tort Claims Act. They don't do that.
So you think they imported the dollar amount limits and the remedies and 101.106 and that's it?
Yes. Yes, because that's all they say that they do. And had they done more, had they put more in, they could have expressly stated that. And the fact that B is stated in there, which is redundant to the Texas Tort Claims Act, gives them that additional protection that I couldn't get a judgment against Baylor as well as the individual physician. This is, I know you just heard the argument on election of remedies. This is before the election of remedies statute. So there was a Thomas versus Oldham, and some of the statutory 101.06 said you can't get a judgment against the agency as well as the individual. And this states that same thing. And had they just adopted the Texas Tort Claims Act and all of its immunity and protection, they wouldn't have had to redundantly put that in there. And again, this is a section dealing with individual liability as opposed to the learned medical institution or medical school or supported medical school limitation on liability, which, again, reading that prior thing, prior 3.12.06 is just goes to the cap. And, you know, frankly, you know, the legislature has, if this was a loophole, if you will, the legislature has corrected this with the new Texas Tort Claims Act that now does put caps on employees of the state. Back under Cassin v. Hatley and the old law, which Cassin v. Hatley still applies parts of it, but again, individual physicians under the old law, state physicians employed by UT did not have official immunity and they were liable as if they were a private citizen. In this case, Dr. Klein's even trying to go beyond that in the sense that asking for other limitations. So again, the whole purpose of the statute was to give Baylor College of Medicine, put it into the same footing as in terms of what they would have to pay out for medical malpractice. And again, this statute came about in the 1987. Time frame, late 1980s. Reading an opinion that was cited, which came out after the initial briefing in this case, in the Sade versus Villarreal case, which petitioner has cited, they go through an analysis that I think it's very clear and why Baylor does not get the entire tort claims protection. Looking at the common question in terms of what does it modify, it's a state agency for purposes of Chapter 104, and given the limitations, and they specifically say it is unlikely and illogical that they would not have completely spelled that out and tried to slip it into an individual liability paragraph when the implications are so far-reaching across the board. What they say, dropping a provision that supported medical schools and certain other medical entities are state agencies for all purposes, a mandate that could have far-reaching effects in the middle of this section, otherwise dealing only with individual liability, makes no sense. So it is trying to fill in the gaps that the legislature did not give Baylor College of Medicine and did not give Dr. Klein that they're trying to get in. And because ultimately, where that boils down to is, as it pertains to this particular action that's before you, is because Dr. Klein is not entitled to all of the protections of the Tort Claims Act, and therefore he is not entitled to appeal either a summary judgment or a plea to the jurisdiction with, according to the immediate interlocutory appeals. That's why the Court of Appeals said they have no jurisdiction over this matter because the Tort Claims Act doesn't apply and give all of the protections to Dr. Klein that he would have otherwise had. So in putting all of the information that we have together, the statute, the literal reading of the statute, what the intent of the legislature was is to give them a cap, which again we concede that Baylor would have a cap if they were a party to the case. The individual physicians are not in, are entitled in reading through this that they can go to Chapter 104 to determine if they have liability. We don't have any problem with that because then we get into the fact that it's not official immunity and under the Cassin v. Hatley argument. So for all of those reasons, First Court of Appeals decision should be left to stand that there was no jurisdiction for the appellate court to continue to consider an interlocutory appeal when the individual bringing the appeal does not meet the statutory requirements of who can file an interlocutory appeal given their official immunity and official capacity.
And with respect to Baylor, the only point of dispute now is whether to vacate the Court of Appeals and trial court's judgment and order?
Yes.
And why should they not be?
I do believe that the non-suit ended all due to justiciable issues between the parties and that it would be an advisory opinion. While we agree with the logic and the conclusions reached by the Court of Appeals, that was a non-suited issue. So the sole issue before is whether Dr. Klein can appeal this issue, and we don't think he has the right to an interlocutory appeal for the reasons that he doesn't get all the protections because the statute and the dealing with the supported medical school and the employed physicians does not extend to them. So with that, that would conclude my argument as to why the Court of Appeals opinion should remain in place and that there be no jurisdiction to hear the appeal.
Any questions? Thank you, Councilor.
If I could start with the Saadi case. Of course, in that case, the court exercised jurisdiction over the doctor's claim for official immunity under 51.014A5. So in that sense, that's the point of disagreement here between the 14th Court of Appeals in Saadi and Young and the First Court of Appeals here and in Zimmerman, the case that's also pending before you. It exercised jurisdiction. Here, of course, the court declined to exercise jurisdiction. Let there be no mistake, Dr. Klein has asserted official immunity. Defendant's third amended answer. This is volume 3 of the record at page 550. He pleads the affirmative defense authorized by Chapter 312, limiting liability from suit and immunity. The affirmative defense authorized by Chapter 312 includes, but is not limited to, official immunity. The defendant's motion for summary judgment, supplemental motion for summary judgment and motion to dismiss, pages 375 and 383 of the record, volume 3. Again, expressly cites the official immunity defense, says satisfied all elements necessary for official immunity, correctly asserted that they have official immunity. They've asserted, whether or not he's proven it, of course, is not before the court at this juncture, but he has certainly asserted it. And so in that sense, we are similar to Saadi in that sense, that he's asserted official immunity and he has a right to have that assertion heard by the Court of Appeals. That's the sticking point here. To go further into the Saadi case, of course, once we get past that initial jurisdictional hurdle, we're talking about the determining liability, if any, portion. The Saadi court ignored the if any part and sliced determining liability very fine. Apparently, according to that court, you're not really determining liability when you're determining immunity from suit. So apparently you can be immune from suit, but you're somehow not determining liability. We, of course, disagree with that notion. If you are immune from suit, you are of necessity not liable. You cannot be liable. And so if you cannot be liable, that it should be part of the determination of liability. So in that sense, we disagree with Saadi. But as to the jurisdictional argument, it's right on. Of course, we agree with respondent with regard to the vacation. It seems we're all in agreement now that at least the Court of Appeals opinion as to Baylor needs to be vacated because obviously the constitutional issue of standing that we're dealing with, the lack of a case or controversy, should precede the analysis of whether or not you have a statutory basis for the appeal. In all but the most unusual cases, and this is not an unusual case, we're all in agreement. We have a non-suit. It was issued something like 3 months before the orders that we're dealing with. And so in that sense, the Court of Appeals opinion is advisory as to Baylor and must be vacated. If there are no further questions, I'll surrender the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The clause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.